Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What do you think about social issues and political commentary making its way into spaces outside of politics, like sports?
It's terrible. It's just not right, you know? Sports the sport, you know? Just let them play and everything else should just be what it is, you know?
I just don't think it should be political to not be racist or not be sexist. I don't think there's a problem with expecting somebody who is a public figure and is in charge of like a very well-known team to not be racist.
So when you hear of these frequent controversies, how does it make you feel about something like sports?
There is an issue within pretty much every field of like all of these different like deep-seated social justice issues. To cut everything out of your life is just impossible. We can call out these people, but we shouldn't just be like, all right, we're never watching football again.
This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and this week we are talking football. We are in the heart of the NFL season, and it does appear to be as popular as ever. The league just announced that the average game this season has had more than 17 million viewers, which is a huge increase from last season. This despite all that the league has endured. It has repeatedly been at the center of our national culture wars. There were the revelations of brain-damaging concussions and the conversations that spurred about fetishizing violence and about the corruption that seems endemic among the rich and the powerful. There was Colin Kaepernick and the conversations his banishment started about really everything from the role of protest in sports, labor organizing, and free speech, and on and on and on. And now, one of the league's most high-profile coaches and a formerly marquee name at ESPN is the subject of this week's culture war. The coach, John Gruden of the Las Vegas Raiders, has resigned after the New York Times published the details of his email exchanges with other powerful people in the league spanning more than a decade, in which he repeatedly said horribly racist, sexist, and homophobic things about everybody from the commissioner to the referees, and in which he exchanged topless photos of cheerleaders. Now, to some, this did not come as a shock. Rich white guy in the NFL is a bigot. Who knew? To others, Gruden has become the latest martyr, another white man taken down by the dark and feminine forces of wokeness. But as we started talking about this story on our team over the past week, we got curious about what is probably a much larger group, which is those of you out there who just, you know, love the sport and maybe don't know how to square that love with stuff like this. And as we talked about that, it kind of felt like a really useful way to have a conversation that actually goes beyond football about what it does or doesn't matter when this kind of bigotry shows up in our communities and corners of our lives that we otherwise cherish, and about how we react when that happens. So maybe we can learn something from how the football fans among us here are reacting to John Gruden. I'll be joined later by sports writer and podcaster Dave Zirin, who is himself coming to us straight from a football game. And we're going to take your calls on a few different questions. Hopefully we can get to all of them. Here's my first question. If you watch football, what do you get out of it? Maybe it's community, for instance. So what does that look like? And my second question is, if you're watching football, how has this business of John Gruden's bigoted emails come up amongst the people you're watching it with? Can you share anything about the conversation that has emerged in your fan world? We'll talk with Dave Zirin and take your calls right after a break.
Hey everyone, it's Kusha. I'm a producer. Last week, we challenged you to ask someone in your life whether they believe racism is permanent in America and to report back to us. Here's a response from James Abro in New York, who's an activist for homeless rights.
We will be a non-racist country if we stop intentionally segregating ourselves from one another. Now, I don't know how we get there, but we will be a racist society as long as we are segregated from one another. What is going to make us not be segregated, I'm not sure. But I'm sure that that's the only way we will get around this. There's no social program, there's no intellectual hijinks. People have to start living with one another and accepting them as they are and finding the beauty in the other race, not just something to not like.
Please keep sending your responses. Is racism permanent in America? If yes, what does that mean for our individual actions? And if no, what is left for us to do? Email your recording or message to us at anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm joined now by a friend of the show who's kind of becoming our go-to source for sports conversations. Dave Zirin is a columnist and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, an editor for The Nation magazine, and author of many books, most recently, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Dave, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming, and I know that we dragged you, in fact, out of your football Sunday. You came to us from a game, right? What game were you at?
I was at the Baltimore Ravens game against the Los Angeles Chargers, who I still occasionally call the San Diego Chargers. I'll admit that. And the Baltimore Ravens won 34-6, so it was a great time. I was with my kid, I was with my father-in-law, and we had fun.
All right. Well, I mean, that's a good segue to the question that I want to start with, which is the same question sort of I asked our listeners before we get into all the gritty details of John Gruden, and there is much to discuss. Answer that first part of the question that I put out to callers. You're a football fan. Why do you watch? What does it do for you?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first and foremost, you know, I'm somebody who lives in a community that has largely been hollowed out, like so many communities. Like, I have no Elks Club. I have no union. I have no central meeting place to discuss with people what's going on in the world. And in my community, like in so many communities, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. So you have football. And football becomes something that's a point of bonding between house to house, community to community, neighbors, the parents of my kids' friends. It can become this common language that we're able to discuss. And I think, you know, football is really the closest thing in our divided, divisive country that we have to a common language and a monoculture at this point in 2021.
Wow. That's pretty strong endorsement. That common thing, the closest thing we've got to a common language. Wow.
No. It's not I want to be really clear about this. It's not an endorsement. I feel like it's much more of an action. I think it's a darn shame. And a crying shame. But I think it's also about, you know, recognizing objective reality. It's like the old expression, you don't have to believe in gravity to fall out of an airplane. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to think football is a good thing or a positive thing or any sort of productive moral force, because I don't think it is. But it still is that glue that can tie a community together in absence of other social bonds, which have been frayed so dramatically over the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah. So it's a statement of its power, and its power in people's personal lives, which is, I think, what's important here. Now, Dave, help us lay out just the dirty details of this story for the non-football fans out there, because it's kind of a doozy. So let's start with who John Gruden is inside the league and what it is he's done. Get us all read in.
Absolutely. I mean, John Gruden for years has been one of the most prominent front and center personalities in the entire world of the National Football League, because he had the plum broadcasting job. After spending over a decade as a coach in the National Football League, the blonde, very, you know, handsome, very articulate Gruden became the color commentator or the analyst, as it were, on Monday Night Football. And, you know, that's as plumb as it gets. in the world of National Football League broadcasting. So he effectively became one of the faces of the league until about 4 years ago, when he was hired on a 10-year, $100 million contract to coach the Oakland Raiders. Now, what was significant about this hire was that everyone knew they were going to leave Oakland. And first it was thought they were going to go to Los Angeles, and that they lost the going to Los Angeles in a bidding war. But then the true plum, and I'm using that word a lot, but this is the true plum, which is going to Las Vegas. And now the Oakland Raiders are the Las Vegas Raiders. They've opened it like a $2 billion stadium, and Gruden was really going to be the face of that, the NFL going into Las Vegas. And it's more than just going into Vegas. It's about the NFL entering the lucrative world of gambling,
right,
which just produces billions of dollars in revenue that's a stream that beforehand did not exist. And so Gruden was really the person with his hand on the lever for this entirely new opening of revenue for the National Football League.
And so this is how important this guy is. He's sitting at the center of it. And then so these emails come out. How did we find out about the emails and what was in them?
I mean, first of all, people have to understand this. This isn't really a Gruden email story. It's a Washington football team story. Mm-hmm. And people might hear that and go, huh? What are you talking about? You were just talking about the Las Vegas Raiders. But here's the thing. There's an investigation going on into rampant sexual harassment and worse among the Washington football team and the relationships, and I use that word in huge quotes, between team executives and the cheerleaders. And there are over 650,000 emails that were collected by the National Football League as part of their internal investigation into the culture of the team. What you have right now are some leaks, and we don't know where the leaks are coming from. There is so much conjecture over this. It's like a game of Clue. People are trying to figure out, you know, who is leaking this. And the leaks that have come out, there have only been a couple of leaks, like a few emails. And the few emails that have been leaked, as you said, show Gruden to use racist, sexist, and homophobic language in communications with Bruce Allen, who, in addition to being the former team president of the Washington football team, is also the brother of George Allen, who you might remember as the former governor of Virginia, whose presidential aspirations were torn apart when he himself used a racial slur to describe an opposing campaign staffer. People might remember that story. And so it was him and Bruce Allen having these communications. It was him sending these kinds of disgusting verbiage over the course of 7 years to Bruce Allen and to other very, very powerful people, like the co-founder of the Hooters restaurant chain and the founder of a prominent fried chicken consortium in the southeast of the United States. So among these, you know, good old boys, there's no other way to put it, very wealthy white men, they're trading in this kind of like very derisive language. And that caused such a huge storm that Gruden, even though this was against so strongly the wishes of the franchise owner of the Las Vegas Raiders, Mark Davis, Gruden found himself out of a job.
Yeah. I mean, what blows my mind, and so, the, you know, as I read about these emails, it's a lot of it sounds really defensive, right? Like, it's a lot of like making fun of the fact that there's a woman who's refereeing. It's that making fun of that there's a gay player who's been drafted. It's, you know, the black head of the Players Association is this and that other racial slur. And it just, I think about like, this is a guy, as you said, making $100 million. $100 million over 10 years. He's got a big respected name, unmatched fairly influence and power in his world. And yet he feels this threatened by a gay player and a woman being a ref. And it just, I don't know, that level of fragility is shocking to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it is. And
it's interesting, Kai, because we can talk about it as fragility. And I do think that's a part of it. I also think it helps to think of it as comfort. That here are these wealthy, white, and people of tremendous power and influence who lord over a game that's played 70% by Black American players. And also a league, by the way, that 47% of its fan base are women. And yet they are in this cosseted country club of rich white men who run the sport. And they feel so comfortable throwing these kinds of words around. No sense of I don't think appreciation is the right word, but no sense of respect, I guess, is the word I'm looking for the people that actually make the game what it is. I mean, you can cut the revenue in half if women are out of the equation. If you cut black players out of the equation, there is no National Football League unless you really like place kicking and offensive linemen. So you know, you're in this position where it's been like a window for people to sort of hear what many of us have always suspected. And the reason why this kind of attitude has always been suspected is because there is this racial contradiction that really oversees the entire sport, that the sport is almost based upon, in that you have black players and almost exclusively white ownership. And that filters down into almost exclusively white executives, almost exclusively white coaches. And so there's an institutionalized racism in the NFL that they deny when pressed on it. But then you see these emails, and for a lot of folks, it's been like, bang, there it is. Please no longer spit in my face and tell me it's raining.
Yeah. Well, let's go to some callers. Let's go to Dorian in Queens. Dorian, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kai. Very nice to speak with you. I'm honored to do so. I wanted to address a specific aspect of what I find to be the hypocrisy of the situation, which is specifically you talked about Coach Gruden sending pictures of topless cheerleaders and denigrating the cheerleaders. And the hypocrisy I want to address is I don't understand why football games, and it's a very violent sport, but I also find it to be a very beautiful sport in many ways. I don't understand what having these hypersexualized women in these very tight outfits doing things that are frankly sexualized has to do with the sport or even cheerleading. You know, we see cheerleading at college football games. It's actually leading cheers. And I don't see men in very tight clothes dancing in that way at WNBA games. So, you know, that's to me a further hypocrisy that I think can be addressed, is why are women put in this situation at a football game? What does it even have to do with the game, really?
And Dorian, before I get Dave's answer to that, you are a football watcher, it sounds like. Why? What is it that it brings for you?
I enjoy the strategy. I enjoy the athleticism, and sometimes there's just such a beauty. You know, when a quarterback can throw a 50-yard pass to somebody running at full speed, and that pass is caught on their fingertips, or when there's some amazing end-around run where, you know, these players shift positions and move in a strategic way to block out the others, or there's, you know, an amazing defensive play where you can see that he read the quarterback. All of that, there's a beauty in the sport, a strategy, a finesse that I really appreciate.
Yeah. And has this news of John Gruden come up for the people you're talking to and your sort of friends in your fan group? And if so, how are you guys talking?
Yeah, we're aware of it. I mean, we're aware of it. Some of my friends, roll their eyes and say, ugh, God, you know, another one, like some of my, meaning another sort of Me Too thing. Some of my friends say, why are they digging up 10-year-old emails? You know, they had these, they're trying to get him. Some of them say, yeah, he deserves to be kicked out. These things were unconscionable, both on a racial basis and a sort of gender basis. But I'm addressing I'm saying I hear what all my friends are saying, and I understand, and I accept it with an open mind. I don't know what's right, but I do find a contradiction in, as I said, you talked about the specific aspect of him showing pictures of topless cheerleaders and some of the sexualized stuff that was done in these emails. And I say there's an even deeper inherent contradiction here.
Thank you for that, Dorian. Dave, what about that? What about the sort of sexual harassment and the sexualization of this in the first place? As you said, this comes out of an investigation into sexual harassment at the Washington football team. But I also just wonder about the deeper cultural question that Dorian's posing there in terms of, like, you know, what the cheerleaders and the sexualized cheerleaders say about who this is supposed to be for in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, in like all things, we can blame the Dallas Cowboys for this. Because cheerleading dates back in the NFL to the 1960s with the Baltimore Colts. That was the first team to ever have a cheerleading squad. They're now called, of course, the Indianapolis Colts. And it was very, I don't know what the word for it would be, like very proper. like the role of cheerleaders. It was like in the college format of leading cheers, and you would have men helping to lead the cheers and all the rest of it. And it was the Dallas Cowboys in the 1970s who took it to that very hyper-sexualized place. Mm-hmm. And it became wildly popular as part of branding the Cowboys as America's team. And so team after team followed suit in that way. And today, cheerleaders are more than just people who are on the field. They're people who act as emissaries for the team in the other days of the week and do public relations events. And so they're kind of like the public face of these different teams. And in the Washington football team case, they're also quite heroic in coming forward in a very difficult situation to speak about the reality of how they're treated. And it's as ugly as one might fear. And hopefully they're listened to now, because one of the things the cheerleader, if people want to support them, what they're calling for is the release of all 650,000 emails. We've literally seen like a dozen out of 650,000. And an anonymous source said to the Associated Press, all the racism, sexism, and homophobia has been revealed. The other emails are great. And it's like, first of all, the Associated Press never should have run with that story based on one anonymous source. I think there's a journalistic issue there. But also, I think that, you know, what we have in front of us is a scandal that's not going anywhere.
Let's go to Joe in Queens. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're a football fan, I take it?
I am a very proud Indianapolis Colts fan. I'm a very proud Hoosier. I'm originally from Indiana. So I'm just such an intense fan of the Indianapolis Colts.
I too am from Indiana and was an Indianapolis Colts fan when I was younger as well. So why do you watch, and has this come up in your circles?
Yeah, so I watch less about the strategy of the sport. As the previous caller mentioned, they like to enjoy, but I watch for nostalgia. I really am always rooting for Indiana, not just athletics, but to improve. Indiana has certainly had a history of racism and bigotry. And among my group of friends and family, I like to think, some of the voices who try and, you know, chat about against that and use social media and promote like good things that are happening in our home state, good things that the team are doing. You know, teams do community events and community services. And the only thing that we can do is really try and promote the good things that are happening. But I watch for nostalgia. I watch, cause I'm incredibly proud to be from Indiana, and I'm always rooting for progress to be made there.
Thanks for that, Joe. It kind of reminds me of myself, to be honest, Dave, because it's, you know, I too, when I was watching, it was a lot about nostalgia. I can remember, you know, speaking of the Colts, I remember before the Colts came to Indianapolis, and my dad and my uncle would go, you know, they would drive up to Northern Indiana to get a hotel room to be in the Chicago Bears viewing area so that we could watch Bears games together. And it would just be so exciting, like this time that we would spend together. And a lot of that was stamped on me. And so this is sort of, again, what you were talking about when we started our conversation, just about, it's one of the things that gives us a shared language or gives us some community.
Yeah, that's something that keeps me coming back, even when I see all the problems with it. I like to think that a couple of things. First is that we need to think less about rejecting parts of our culture, not just football, but parts of our culture that we find to be objectionable, and fight to reclaim them. You know, I think people take that as a given when it comes to things like film or television or radio. You know, you hear people say that all the time. I'm going to make better films. I'm going to do better TV. I'm going to do better radio to wrest it away from forces of reaction. But when it comes to sports, people sometimes treat it the way a vegetarian treats a McRib. You know, you just push it away and say, you know, this is inherently awful and everything about it is awful. When in fact, you know, there are good things there, but you got to fight for those good things and fight to reject what you don't like.
Right. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back and take more of your calls with sports writer Dave Zirin. If you're a football fan, we want to know why. And if you are watching, we want to know if this news about John Gruden's bigoted emails has come up in your circles. What's the conversation you're having? How are you handling it? 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. 435-7280 or tweet us using the hashtag US of Anxiety. We're going to talk about leadership models some of us learned from football and why all of this matters beyond the NFL. Stay with us.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm talking with sports writer Dave Zirin, host of the Edge of Sports podcast and author of several books, most recently The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. We've been talking about the latest NFL scandal involving now former Las Vegas Raiders coach John Gruden. He's resigned after years of his email exchange with other powerful people in the league became public, revealing a torrent of racist and misogynist and homophobic conversations about other people in the league. So Saturday Night Live last night had a skit about this story where they spoofed NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell trying to do damage control on this, even while he himself was the target of a lot of the name calling. Here's a bit of that skit.
Good evening. Hi, I'm Roger Goodell. And when you see me on TV, it's never good. This time, one of our coaches is accused of racism, misogyny, and homophobia. But hey, at least no one's talking about concussions. I think we can all agree the emails sent by Raiders coach John Gruden were horrifying and deeply offensive, especially to me. I was referred to as the F word, the P word, the C word, the R word, the effing R word, and the effing R word P word. And once, weirdly, I was called a DILF. That was kind of sweet. But I assure you, all 32 teams in our league understand that diversity is our strength. And I know our Black coaches would agree. Both of them.
So, Dave, part of the joke here is that there's been scandal after scandal with the NFL. But why Roger Goodell? Why was he such a target for John Gruden and the folks who don't like change in the league?
Oh, Kai, first of all, what's the R word? This one is causing me to get a little...
Well, I don't want to speculate on the radio.
Okay, let's not speculate, but just I grew up in New York City, so I like to think I have a healthy vocabulary. So that one's a bit of a surprise. Here's the thing. Before Roger Goodell, commissioners of the National Football League cared about nothing more than profit, bottom line stuff. And they were very transparent about it. Like, this is what we're about. We're the NFL. We play football. You don't like it, don't watch. Roger Goodell's approach is best summed up by his slogan, football is family. And it's this idea that football should be everything to everybody. And football should be a voice against breast cancer. Football should be a voice to fight violence against women, you know, both of those things very much geared towards this growing audience of women football fans. And football should be a voice against racism, you know, that's why they've got end racism in the end zones and people can wear anti-racist decals on their helmets. And it's this idea of him, I think, being way too big for his shoes, as it were. Like, thinking that football, which is a very violent sport that has a very nasty underbelly, can somehow be this light, a shining light on a hill for the entire nation. And that's what really gets him in a lot of trouble sometimes, because the reality is that when you have a violent game with lots of money and lots of drugs, and when I say drugs, I'm more talking about legal drugs to shoot people up to make sure they're out on the field, even if they're hurt, you're going to have conflict and you're going to have problems. And when you have a sport that's so deeply invested in white supremacy at the top of the sport among franchise ownership, I mean, you're going, these instances like what happened with Gruden are more of an inevitability, and scandal is more of an inevitability than good times and us people rejoicing and saying, yay, football is family.
It's interesting. It's almost, it starts to sound like quite a metaphor for the country at large. I mean, that there's all of these sort of words, right, about
yes.
what a liberal and a plural society should look like, but that the people who hold the power are not prepared to have that society, and they'll run you right out of town if you try to do that as a leader.
And also similarly, like you have a situation where John Gruden's words were abhorrent in these emails, but you see the NFL turn the volume up to 20 and say, this is an outrage about these emails. Let's just not talk about how many black executives there are. Let's just not talk about how many black coaches there are. Let's not just talk about, you know, the realities of the healthcare that we offer to players after they retire. You know, I did a book with Michael Bennett, former Seattle Seahawk, called Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. And that was Michael's idea for the title. And it you know, made me a little uncomfortable, but that's okay. And Michael's whole point, his thesis for the book is like, yo, this is going to make you uncomfortable, but guess what? The NFL is a segregated product, not an integrated product. Like, we are actively watching segregation because there's a segregation between those who manage and own franchises and those who actually play and bear the brunt of the pain of the work.
Let's go to Jan in Waynesville, North Carolina. Jan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I must say, I'm not a big fan of football. I mean, I guess I'm indifferent to football, but I don't regularly watch. I maybe watch one game every few years. But the whole culture that concerns me is the behavior of men specifically, and I'm going to say white men, because really white men are in charge of the country. They make the laws, you know, they just hold so many positions of power. And so when it comes to racist behavior, misogyny, rape of women and children, I just see that this behavior is not going to stop until men, but specifically white men, decide that it's going to stop because of the position of power that white men typically hold in our culture. I don't see these problems as stopping until white men get the balls or, you know, just to hold each other accountable and say, this is not okay. As a white woman, if I hear someone make a racist comment, I say something. I hold the person accountable because we at white people, as white people, we're not supreme. It's white supremacy, you know, and again, the racist behavior, it just all needs to stop. And it is white men predominantly who need to hold each other and accountable and decide that it's going to stop.
Jan, thank you for that. Dave, on this question of, you know, one thing she's getting to is like who is on the receiving end of John Gruden's messages. We've talked about Bruce Allen, but what are we hearing about the sort of response from everybody else in the NFL? To Jan's point, are there other people standing up and saying, you know, and particularly other white men, either owners or stars in the league, standing up and saying no?
No, I mean, what you're getting is a lot of eye rolls because of the line from the NFL that, well, this is a Gruden problem or that this is a Bruce Allen problem, you know, and not something that's far more systemic. And there are other folks who are pointing out that, you know, one of the things that John Gruden talks about is Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed, two players who took a knee in opposition to police violence and racial inequity, about how they should be forced out of the game. And, you know, so this is something where it's people, there's a lot of attitude. Unfortunately, and I say that very unfortunately, the response really has been much more about cynicism, you know, and being like, this is exactly what the league is. And I don't want this to be a cynical moment because cynicism usually leads to passivity. I want this to be a moment where all the forces in the NFL, the union is doing this, and several very prominent reporters are doing this, and the Washington football cheerleaders are doing this, but I want to hear the players, the coaches, executives, all calling for these emails to be released, all 650,000, and have a real house cleaning of the National Football League.
Right. I do want to play a little bit of what another coach did say in response to this scandal, because his comments, at least it seems to me, have been a little viral online. This is Los Angeles Chargers coach Brandon Staley at a press conference this week.
Yeah. You know, I think this is what I think about it. You know, I think that respect and trust in this world are really, really difficult to achieve. And I think about all the people that were affected by those emails. Whether you're a person of color, whether you're a person, you know, a gender, your sexual orientation, the people that were affected by those emails, that's who I'm thinking about. You know, because it's a sacred mantle for someone to call you coach or someone to call you a leader. And trust is really, really hard to achieve in this world. It's really, really challenging to achieve. And especially with people, with those groups that I just mentioned. All right, and people are really guarded, all right, and they're skeptical of people because of emails like that. And I just think that, you know, kindness and lifting people up and respecting people you don't know, I just think that, you know, that's such a big part of our thing here, is listening to people and learning about people, because I think what you'll discover is that we have so much more in common than not.
And Dave, I play that because of the bit about leadership and trust. We've been talking about professional football, but I'm also thinking a lot about people associated with the sport all the way down the line. I mean, you know, while I was playing football as a kid, leadership values were just a huge part of what I remember learning. And I guess I just want to hear you respond to Coach Staley with his remarks with that context.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think people might understand why people call Brandon Staley Ted Lasso. It sort of has that effect where you feel a little better about yourself and about humanity after you hear him talk. And so credit to Brandon Staley for doing that, because, I mean, this has been a real problem where, you know, there were more people after John Gruden's first email was released, which was like, quote unquote, just racist. You know, the others hadn't come out yet, where more people were defending John Gruden than defending Demoris Smith, the head of the NFL Players Association, we attacked with racist verbiage. But as to what you're saying, I mean, this is something that I found in doing this book, The Kaepernick Effect, and interviewing a lot of high school students about their activism and how their coaches responded, is that there really are two kinds of coaches, the transactional and the transformational. The transactional coach is, they're in it for themselves and how coaching makes them feel. They don't view it as a sacred title, the way Brandon Staley said. And then there's the transformational, who views coaching as a way to figure out how to raise up the young people that are in their charge. And I think we should really go forward and look much more sharply at some of these coaches and ask ourselves that question, who's transactional and who's transformational? Maybe that's less important at the professional level, but at the youth sports level, I think that we should have a very, very strict approach to judging the people coaching our kids.
What kind of stuff were you hearing from kids, you know, in the book when you've gone out and you've talked to people about this Kaepernick effect? What did you hear?
Oh, my, I heard so much that, I mean, someone joked with me that the book should be called What to Expect When You're Protesting, like What to Expect When You're Expecting, because there's so many different scenarios. I interviewed dozens and dozens of people, and the young people, all sorts of different things happened. In some cases, the coach threw him off the team. In other cases, the coach took it as a learning opportunity to bring everybody together and talk as a team about, and really take that phrase about a sports team being like a family and taking that seriously and saying, well, if some members of our family are unhappy, then we all need to talk about it and speak about racism and police brutality as a team. And that made all the difference for these young people, like whether or not they had a positive experience from protesting. And by protesting, I mean taking a knee during the anthem, or if they had a negative, even scarring experience. It all depended really on whether or not the coach was willing to step up and provide leadership at that very tenuous moment, or if they stepped backwards and let the weight of the world fall on the shoulders of these young people.
I mean, it gets to the question of why any of this matters. You know, I mean, I can imagine a lot of people, and, you know, I myself too, sometimes like, oh, who cares? You know, like the National Football League, it's full of billionaires and millionaires, you know, and mm-hmm. So there's this rich white guy who's a racist, lo and behold, shocking, you know, but then it has this echo effect in our culture. And so when you talk about, you know, the community that people, this football is our only shared language. Why do we have to care if John Gruden is a racist?
Well, I mean, the trickle-down effect is very real. And in terms of how, not just coaches, but how I would argue white people more broadly think it's acceptable or not acceptable to speak about other people in the human family. I mean, football is such a powerful cultural weather vane. And so if John Gruden is able to be rehired as an announcer, as a coach very quickly without making any kinds of amends or anything like that, or going on any sort of journey that he shares publicly, I mean, it sends a heck of a message out there, you know, and a message that I think is going to be very well received by what, 40% of the country who's like, yeah, why should he have to apologize? You know, why should he have to do anything? This is about the thought police. Who cares what he thinks?
I mean, to that end.
Yeah, sorry.
There is a great deal of that going on. I mean, Gruden is becoming a martyr to those who feel like the sort of rope brigade is erasing white men. We were sort of monitoring a bunch of online chatter earlier today, even, you know, during game day, we figured, let's see what's going on. And our producer Kusha was on the Reddit board, R Conservative. And there was this conversation coming from an article from a conservative journal called American Greatness called, in the title said, the John Gruden controversy is another reason why conservatives should turn off the NFL. And there's just all of these comments about the hypocrisy of allowing black players to get away with things that are, you know, awful, and why weren't they fired? And, you know, there was one comment, so rampant domestic abuse is forgivable, but hurting a gay person's feelings is too far. What even are liberal priorities anymore? You know, and there's this conversation about boycotting the NFL amongst them. So I guess one, just your reaction to that conversation, like, why isn't it hypocrisy? Or is it hypocrisy? And two, does the NFL care? Does this matter to the NFL that this community of people is like, okay, well, we might be done with you?
Well, of course it's hypocrisy. And it's so funny to see that conservative talking point, because I'm like, yeah, of course there should be zero tolerance for people who abuse people in their family. You know, why do you think there's not a more intelligent question from these folks, which they're not willing to ask, is why that double standard exists in the first place? And they don't want to answer that question, because the double standard exists because the entire league rests upon this racial contradiction. Without a racial labor discipline, there is no National Football League. And that's one of the things that made Colin Kaepernick so dangerous, because he was defying that by taking a knee. That's why they really had to drum him out of the league, because he was sending a message to other black players and white allies that, you know, we don't have to take this. You know, this is our platform. We built it. And that runs against the very autocratic, very top-down structure of the National Football League. So they don't want to raise or address those questions about white supremacy, racial hierarchies, labor. That's not what they want. They just want to score Reddit points by being like, oh, why is this player allowed in the game and then John Gruden isn't? It's just like, God, that's so tired. Stop with the gotcha arguments and address the true elephant in the room, which is that racism is endemic to the National Football League.
What about in the other direction? We just got about 30 seconds, but what does the NFL care about the fans who find Gruden offensive? It seems like they would, because he's lost his job.
No, that's who the NFL cares about, frankly, because they know that's the future. This young generation in this country, Kai, is more demographically diverse and less tolerant of intolerance than any generation in the history of the United States. And the NFL knows that if they are going to have a future, they need to appease that generation.
Dave Zirin is a columnist and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, an editor for The Nation magazine, and author of many books, most recently, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Dave, a pleasure as always.
Thank you so much.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Mixing by Jared Paul. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Frillman, and Kusha Navidar. And I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And as always, please join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker, play WNYC. And until then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.